Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is underwritten by the University of San Francisco School of Business and Management. I'm Mike Duffy, Dean of the University of San Francisco School of Business and Management, and your chair for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Fred Smith, founder and CEO of Federal Express. Fred Smith is one of the greatest examples of the American entrepreneurial spirit. He took an idea which others thought would not work, and over the past 40 years has built an outstanding, successful organization, Federal Express. Today, FedEx is the world's leading express transportation provider, with nearly 300,000 team members delivering almost 8 million packages a day throughout the world. While everyone talks about Wall Street and Main Street, no one talks about Commerce Street, the industrial economy in between. Fred Smith will outline ways to build a foundation for a healthier, sustainable business environment in the United States, one that can create more good-paying jobs here in California and throughout the country. His solutions include energy independence, tax and accounting reform, and policies that grow business, trade, and communities. Smith believes that in the challenge of this downturn is an opportunity to increase America's competitiveness in the global marketplace. Please welcome Fred Smith.
Thank you very much. On behalf of those 300,000 folks that make up the FedEx team, we appreciate your coming tonight to listen to what I have to say. I'm standing here, I can assure you, because of their great efforts over the years. A number of them are in the audience, and I want them to know how much I appreciate what they do for us every day. Very honored to have you here, Mr. Secretary. It was sat right behind you at the alfalfa dinner the other night and didn't get a chance to say hello, but Secretary Schultz and I both have the honor of being Marines, so we share a great heritage in common in that regard. It's a great pleasure to be in California in the middle of the winter, at least in Southern California, where I was yesterday. I did some speaking down there, and I talked to some of our great FedEx LA team members. We've got about 27,000 employees and associates in the great state of California, about 11,500 down in the L.A. Metro area, and between about 4,500, I think, here in the Bay Area. When I was in Los Angeles, I got a chance to visit with two of my daughters, which is another attraction of California to me. Both of them are in the movie business. One of them's an independent producer, and the other one is in the development side of the house. And, you know, it got me to thinking about my own acting career. Some of you may know that I played myself in an 18-second segment giving a speech in the Tom Hanks movie Castaway a few years back. For some reason, he got nominated for the Oscar and I didn't. As a consequence of that disappointment, I've decided it was prudent to keep my day job. Now, you might also recall that Tom's character ends up alone on a tropical island for years. 4 years to be exactly, mostly talking to a volleyball by the name of Wilson. With the current economic situation, I know spending time alone on a tropical island might sound good to a lot of people right now, particularly some of those bankers that were skewered up in Congress this morning. But I'm not one of those people. I think I'm reasonably realistic, and I'm reasonably optimistic, and I firmly believe we can do several things to get our country back on track, which I'd like to talk about today. However, I don't think there's any question that this is the most serious economic situation our country has faced since the end of World War II. To illustrate this particular point, let me tell you a brief anecdote. There was a company down in the LA area that made plastic molded parts. One of their customers owed them $80,000, but that company was having a hard time paying the bill because their bank had, without notice, lowered their credit limits after the customer had sent the check. So the $80,000 check bounced. Eventually, that customer straightened out the funding and paid the bill to the plastics company. But the customer's reduced access to money meant they couldn't pay the plastics company to make more parts. In short, the customer company had orders, but they didn't have the capital to produce the orders with the plastic company's parts. Right now, that plastic company and its customer are struggling to keep their businesses afloat. So we don't know yet exactly how this will come out. But the story is true, and it's a plastics company located in California. And this illustrates exactly the intertwined situation of our financial sector and our business sector. And this particular situation is all too common throughout the U.S. It's contributed to increased business failures, reduced tax revenues, and as well reported the loss of jobs for many, many talented people. The fact is that in this economic downturn, most people, especially politicians and the press, as was mentioned in the introduction, talk about Wall Street and Main Street. But very few, unfortunately, talk about what's in the middle, what I refer to as Commerce Street, the industrial economy in between, and the one with just as many victims as the other two sectors. Let me shine a spotlight on how important such industries are to our American economy. The industrial sector includes businesses that are usually rich in assets, big service companies like FedEx with 80,000 vehicles, 700 airplanes, 5,000 facilities, healthcare providers, warehousers, manufacturers, agriculture, mining, hospitals, and energy producers. The sector is a major driver of our economy. Now, commercial industry may not be as sexy or as prone to be reported upon on CNBC as finance, housing, or retail, but it is in a very critical component of our GDP. Industrial job creation and loss parallel exactly the rise and fall of corporate capital expenditures in the United States. It is a huge component of U.S. GDP and accounts for more than 20% of our total output. Now, despite recent job losses, it's important to notice that California is still one of America's largest manufacturing centers, and in fact, the L.A. Basin is the largest manufacturing center in the United States. One thing that has really benefited the industrial sector, as well as other sectors in our economy, is fast cycle logistics, which offers increased inventory visibility and flexibility. It gives companies more clarity at the point of sale and more visibility of inventory, whether in motion or at rest. So companies using fast cycle logistics can adjust to market conditions much more quickly than in previous economic cycles. Thus, goods don't normally stockpile in warehouses, and store shelves don't go bare. I might add that FedEx has been a very large contributor to this much more flexible economy that we enjoy today. Well, yes, you might say that works well until an economic maelstrom like we're in right now. In the past few months, we've seen huge retail markdowns, plants being shuttered, workers furloughed or laid off or fired, and inventory levels either backed up or not being replenished. Now, I do frankly believe that this situation would have been much, much worse had it not been mitigated through a combination of fast cycle logistics and advanced supply chain information systems. Even so, as more industrial businesses have slowed down or closed, particularly in the fourth quarter of calendar year 2008, the United States has clearly begun to lose its edge in terms of being the locomotive of the global marketplace. The question is, how can we fund continued technological innovation and entrepreneurship if our companies are strapped for cash? How can we fund alternative fuel research if we don't have the research chemists to do the jobs? So today I'd like to try to answer the question, how can we make American companies, particularly in the industrial sector, more competitive in the global marketplace and increase their ability to offer more employment to Americans? We have three proposals. The first is to accelerate allow companies to expense capital investment and purchases of software. The second is to continue to reduce our dependence on imported petroleum. And the third is to continue to champion free trade, which has been the largest single force that has increased our economy since World War II. Let's talk capital investment first. For many years now, United States tax policy has favored the financial sector of our economy over the industrial sector. And as a result, the financial sector has grown disproportionately. 25 years ago, 1983 to be exact, the financial sector comprised a little over 15% of the reported profits of all American businesses. In the last year before the meltdown in 2007, that figure had increased to 32%. And why shouldn't it grow? As the U.S. Treasury Department concluded in a 2007 report on tax reform options, our current system heavily favors debt financing. Interest on debt used to buy business assets is deductible. You and I can deduct the interest on the money we borrow to buy a house, but businesses using their own money and their own cash flow to buy equipment or software cannot deduct the cost of those expenditures. Such assets must be depreciated over several years. In the industrial sector, and in our business in particular, the general rule is that you need a dollar of equity and you might have 10, 15, 20 cents borrowed against it. In contrast, as has been very well reported, for every dollar in equity, you might have 10, 20, or 100 times the equity level on the debt side of the balance sheet. Such over-leveraging, of course, led to the dramatic failure or crisis of our major financial institutions beginning last fall. Now, Winston Churchill once said he would like to see finance less proud and industry more content. It certainly looks as if the first part of that wish has come true. Instead of penalizing capital-intensive companies in the way we do now, we urge Congress to change the tax code to permit U.S. companies of all sizes to write off all of their capital expenditures for equipment and software, not real estate, equipment and software, when the assets are put into service, as opposed to the current system of long-term depreciation. Now, why does this make sense? Tax and economic experts like Ernie Christian and Gary Robbins have said that over time, based on their research, every dollar of tax reduction in the near term that expensing of capital would put into the economy would be multiplied by 9 times in GDP growth. Expensing helps, most importantly, workers. 3/4 of the benefits of business capital investment goes to the workforce over time as they become more productive. Stephen Inten of the Institute for Research on the Economics of Taxation said in a recent Wall Street Journal article that expensing is simply good policy and, quote, more fully reflects the real cost of equipment than depreciation, thereby raising the after-tax returns on investment. It would boost capacity and employment. He, like we, also urged a lower corporate tax rate. We're simply not competitive in that area. We have the second highest corporate tax rate after Japan. But that, of course, is an extremely difficult proposition with the Democratic majority in Congress. Authors Chris Edwards and Daniel Mitchell say in their book, Global Tax Revolution, that if corporations are not building factories and investing in the United States due to high taxes, labor productivity will fall, and that will drag down American wages. Conversely, expensing would completely change the dynamics of the incentives in the industrial sector to invest more quickly, even in downturns, which brings with it the requisite requirement for employment, training, and education. Even without counting the benefits to the economy of new jobs, it's a relatively cheap option for the U.S. Treasury, since the only cost to the government, unlike many of the things in the stimulus package, is the time value of money. The situation, I believe, is very similar to what the Cardinal said to the Godfather, Michael Corleone, in Godfather III, about going to confession. What have you got to lose? The Congress's decision should be just as easy in this regard. Now, how specifically would expensing impact the economy and grow American jobs? Let me use an example from FedEx. If we buy another 777 jumbo jet from Boeing, under the current tax code, we generally can write that asset off over 7 years for tax purposes. But buying a $150 million airplane is a big risk because you don't know what the market is going to be like when that plane is delivered some 4 years after the initial order. So the best way to mitigate the risk of making that capital purchase, which in our case provides jobs for pilots, aviation maintenance technicians, hub workers, and couriers, is to allow the buyer to get that money back quicker. It reduces risk, which is the big thing in consideration in every boardroom in America today, and it encourages investment more quickly in new productivity-enhancing equipment, new technologies, and increases employment. While faster capital expensing is smart tax policy in any case, it's particularly so in times of economic downturn such as the one we're in now. Every corporate board wants to preserve cash, lower capital expenditures, but to stimulate the economy, what society needs is such spending to be brought forward. As everyone in Silicon Valley knows, most business technology, such as high-end computers, data servers, and so forth, becomes obsolete very quickly. Companies must spend the money to update their technology, which in turn will allow them to become more productive, to cut costs, and some of these costs and productivity enhancements will be passed along to their customers, and as the research I mentioned earlier, at 75 cents on the dollar to their workforce. Accelerated depreciation or expensing of capital equipment and software will help industry adopt new productivity-enhancing technology quicker and restore the balance between the industrial sector and the financial sector that I mentioned a moment ago. The second major initiative we propose is to reduce United States dependence on imported oil. Nothing demonstrates the danger of this dependence more than the run-up of gas prices last summer. When a barrel of oil hit an all-time price of $147 a barrel last July, and we were all paying $4.50 or $5 per gallon to fill up, yet that was the match that lit the prime mortgage tinderbox. It forced the paycheck-to-paycheck borrower to literally choose between putting gas in their cars to go to work or paying mortgages and other debt. People simply had to go to work. Right now, over 60% of our petroleum is imported. In the early days of FedEx, in the first of four oil crises that I've lived through, that number was about 30%. That puts a huge dent in our balance of payments account. Last summer, at the height of the oil crisis, that was running around $1 billion a day out of the pockets of American consumers going abroad. Now, it's important in this day of demagoguery against the big oil companies like great institutions like Chevron and Exxon that they are not major players in the scheme of things in the oil business. 90% of all known oil reserves are now owned by national oil companies, not the Exxons and Chevrons of the world. Many of these nationalized oil companies are located in countries with, at best, an ambivalence towards the United States or antipathy towards us and our way of life. Many of the reserves are in expensive and inhospitable and expensive locations as well. Our dependence on these sources means that foreign petroleum is an enormous national security issue as well as an economic risk. I am the co-chair of the Energy Security Leadership Council, an organization of large business CEOs which use petroleum, and about 10 four-star retired military and naval officers, many of whom were involved in protecting the oil trades. And our goal in the Energy Security Leadership Council has been to recommend policies to the Congress and the President that will reduce the United States' dependence on imported petroleum. One of our members testified last month before the Senate Energy Committee and made our case for the three recommendations of the ESLC. The first is the diversification of U.S. transportation fuels, primarily by the electrification of short-haul personal automotive transportation. The second is the acceleration of the development of new energy-related technologies. And the third, which is increased access to our domestic oil and natural gas supplies. The ESLC urges research of all kinds of alternative fuels with the goal of making them fully competitive economically as quickly as possible. In this regard, we're certainly talking solar, wind, natural gas, biodiesel, geothermal, and one of my all-time favorites, algae. Most people do not realize, but algae is a prolific eater of carbon dioxide. It can double in mass quickly, sometimes in as little as 4 to 6 hours. Sounds like a pretty good screenplay for a horror flick from one of my daughters. Algae, all kidding aside, has 30 times the amount of oil inside its molecular structure than cellulose ethanol does. That gives it huge potential for the production of jet and diesel fuel. In fact, you could produce enough jet fuel for the entire world in a landmass about the size of West Virginia as compared to other biofuels, which would take a landmass the size of the United States. Over the past year, there have been 4 successful demonstration flights with 4 different aircraft by 4 different air carriers with a 50-50 blend of biofuels made from Jatropha, camelina, and algae. So this is not pie-in-the-sky thinking. My personal belief is that within 20 years, at least half of all of the fuel consumed by worldwide aviation will be from renewable sources like algae. At FedEx, we very much believe in researching and using alternative sources of energy in addition to biofuels. Here in California, we've invested in 3 major solar-powered facilities, the largest of which is right here in the Bay Area at our major Oakland hub, and we've been producing almost 1 megawatt of electricity reliably now for 3.5 years in that facility. We're upgrading our air fleet by replacing our older narrow-body aircraft with aircraft that reduce fuel consumption up to 36% per flight while providing 20% more capacity. We pioneered, along with the Eaton Corporation and the Environmental Defense Fund, the first commercial hybrid pickup and delivery fleet, and we now have the largest such fleet of this type in North America, with some of them handling pickup and delivery operations right here in downtown San Francisco. They are 42% more fuel efficient, 90% more emission efficient than the diesel comparable size vehicle. In the United Kingdom, we introduced liquid petroleum gas vans that reduce carbon emissions by 12%, and in Italy, we've begun testing hybrid diesel electrics designed for the European market. In Japan, we teamed up with General Motors to test a fuel cell delivery vehicle. Our goal is to improve fuel efficiency for our entire FedEx vehicle fleet 20% by the year 2020. So far, we're at 13.7% when we began that campaign. We believe the quickest and easiest way to wean American industry and consumers away from imported oil is to promote, as I mentioned a moment ago, electric vehicles, another recommendation of the ESLC. Right now, about 75% of all personal car travel is less than 40 miles a day. For our own pickup and delivery trucks, it's about 100 miles a day on average. Now, the thing about electrical power is it can be produced by many sources that are environmentally friendly: water, wind, natural gas, geothermal, hydro, solar. Already, we have the basic infrastructure to power tens of millions of vehicles, and if we overhaul the electric grid, we can recharge millions more. To power the next day's driving, most recharging can be done overnight at garages, businesses, and homes. Recharge cycles are becoming shorter, and in a few years, many will be less than an hour. The fact is, electricity cannot be stored. And so those tens of millions of vehicles that will be introduced in the next few years will almost be fuel for free on a ratio of about 1-6 in terms of investment, in terms of expanding the capacity. There are entrepreneurs working throughout the world on a number of new improved battery technologies for longer range. One company, Better Places, is working on a system in which you drive up and swap your depleted battery for a fully charged one in about the time it would take to pump a tank full of gas. Better Places is rolling out pilot projects here in San Francisco and in Hawaii and Israel. So there's lots of creative thinking on this already. If we pass legislation to incent manufacturers, consumers, state and local governments through tax credits or production credits, we could rapidly shift American electrical vehicle production into overdrive. While we can and do many things to reduce our need for foreign oil, the fact is that America's need for oil is not going to disappear anytime soon. So we've also got to expand the domestic supply of petroleum as we go to this brave new world. The Energy Security Leadership Council urges increasing the access of the United States to oil and natural gas reserves, which are currently restricted. Now, I'm very well aware that this may not be popular with some people, but environmental protection methods and technologies have greatly improved in the past few years, and I believe the case for increased production is clear. Not only does the purchase of foreign oil put a big dent in our balance of payments, but we also spend an enormous amount protecting it. According to the generals and admirals on the ESLC, as much as 60% of our defense budget is directly or indirectly related to protecting the oil trade. And I don't think that is what we want to keep spending our money on in the years ahead. Reducing dependence on foreign oil must be a serious, sustained national effort. It certainly involves trade-offs, and I understand the difficulties involved. But I would hope that both political parties will commit themselves to this effort in a spirit of principled compromise. Reducing imported petroleum will boost the American economy greatly. It will spur new technology on many fronts, which in turn grows jobs, particularly in the energy field and in the auto sector. The third proposal we'd make is to jumpstart the American economy is by continuing to promote the benefits of free trade. In his inaugural address, President Obama reminded us that the market is unmatched in its ability to generate wealth. He said, "The success of our economy has always depended not just on the size of our gross domestic product, but on the reach of our prosperity." Quite simply, trade creates jobs here in the United States and around the world. Most people don't realize it, but trade accounts for 1 in 5 American jobs, and they are higher-paying positions at that. Here in California, almost 4 million jobs are trade-related, and nationwide, the net impact of trade upon manufacturing is positive. In the service sector, where we work, total trade is about $480 billion, and the United States enjoys a positive balance of payments surplus of about $140 billion. Make no mistake about it. If we want to continue to prosper, trade must become even more important to our future. By 2030, there will be 7 billion people in the world, and Americans will be about 5% of that. So we have to look at the other 95% of the world as our customers. As middle classes expand in other countries, our potential markets will grow too, faster than our domestic market by all accounts. So to maintain our prosperity, we must, as the generations before us, continue to champion open markets. And that includes exports and imports. Both are critical to our success. Now, there's a great popular favor for exports. Everyone in the political classes understands our U.S. companies that ship exports. but they often overlook the tremendous value of imports in terms of improving the quality of life of American citizens. This dispute about trade is not a new phenomenon. One of my favorite stories is about a famous economist in France in the 1830s, Jean Bastiat, noting the preference of the politicians for exports and their antipathy towards imports, he provided a modest solution, which was to build a fleet of cargo ships, manufacture all sorts of goods, put them on the ship, sail them 3 miles offshore, and sink them. And as a great economist like Secretary Schultz will tell you, that is a sure path to oblivion in short order. Some eschew the purchase of so-called foreign goods. Remember, however, that foreign-headquartered companies create American jobs. Honda, Toyota, Nissan, BMW, and other car makers have created tens of thousands of American jobs in California, the South, and the Midwest. Other foreign companies provide employment in the service sector. The largest food service company is French-owned, for example. Did you know in our article in the Wall Street Journal last month noted that the Toyota Sequoia, a Japanese car, is 80% domestic content, while one of its competitors, the Jeep Patriot, an American car, is 65% domestic content? There's a temptation now for countries to retreat into their own economic shells, and one misguided manifestation of that is the Buy America proposal in the stimulus package. I believe it's been moderated, but it is important again to recall is that trade is the main reason the world has enjoyed substantially greater prosperity and higher standards of living since World War II. Ask the people of China, India, and Vietnam how their standard of living improved when they gained access to the open market and its goods, services, and ideas. And while you're at it, why don't you check with the people of North Korea and see how they're doing, walled off economically and politically from the rest of the world? Now, I realize that we all enjoy the benefits of open trade, but some of us also experience personally the pain of it. Well-known economist Burton Malkiel said last week in a Wall Street Journal, and said it well, the pain tends to be localized while the benefits are spread broadly, but the total benefits exceed the costs. Malkiel goes on to recommend that displaced workers receive better job training and a better safety net during the transition period. He also recommends revamping our educational system to prepare workers for current jobs, but also to give them the flexible skills needed for jobs in the future. Protectionism will not keep America or any country competitive in the long run. We live in a truly borderless economy, particularly in the high technology and high value added products that this area of the country is so well known for. And our trade practices must reflect that. That's why we urge the Congress to pass the free trade agreements with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea that have been negotiated. The California Chamber of Commerce strongly supports these agreements because they are good for the state's powerful economy, especially as a key player in the Asia-Pacific market. We hope that the Congress and the President will take up and push the Doha rounds of trade talks to further lower trade barriers in the same spirit that the Uruguay round of trade talks did a few years ago. We believe that we've got to reform our immigration laws to make it easier for talented people from other countries to work in the United States. Immigrants played key roles in the formative years of Silicon Valley, as everyone in this room knows. They played in previous generation major roles in the movie business, the garment industries, and in the wine business. The same could be said of many other industries in other parts of the country. Shutting the door on legal immigrants who bring new ideas, work ethic, and entrepreneurship to America is shutting the door on our future. Over the past decade, shared global prosperity has lifted millions out of poverty and bound nations together. I would have never believed, as a young Marine coming through Asia in the 1960s out of Vietnam, the transformation that has taken place out there. dragging hundreds of millions of impoverished people in China out of their state of sustenance existence has been a very good thing for the world. Particularly in this time of worldwide economic instability, we must work together with all nations to increase access to goods, service, and ideas, not decrease it. If nations turn their backs on each other through protectionist measures, instead of using the R word or the recession, we might well be using the D word or the depression. As history shows, in the 1930s, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs enacted by Congress were a major contributor to moving the United States into a Great Depression. In summary, I believe that we can face down today's challenges with that famous American ingenuity, determination, and optimism that have kept us a world leader for so long. The three suggestions that I've made today require little in the way of direct government money. By stimulating the industrial sector to invest more in equipment and software quicker, even in downturns, by reducing our dependence on imported petroleum, and by ensuring that world markets remain open and our access to other markets improves, we can begin to move the United States economy in the right direction. The only thing we really need is the political will to make these things happen. If we do, then I think we can transform my so-called Commerce Street into a more powerful force here in California, and we can help straighten the crown America has worn for so long as the world's economic leader. Thank you. Now I understand I have to sing for my supper here. I have to answer some questions. So I hope you sent some zingers up here.
Okay. Our thanks to Fred Smith, founder and CEO of Federal Express, for his provocative comments today. So thank you again.
Thank you.
And I'm Lenny Mendonca, chairman of McKinsey & Company's Global Institute and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. And I'll help moderate today's question and answer period from the audience. Mr. Smith, we have a large number of questions. I'm going to try to get to as many of them as I can in the time we've got. For those of you, if I don't get to your question, I'm going to try and group them because there were several that were related, but I'll do my best to get to them. They're in three main categories, a set of them that are related to the Federal Express business. So let me start with those first, if that's okay. There were a set of questions about your outlook on the economy and your views going forward, and then a set of questions related to the policy suggestions that you raised.
Okay.
But let's start with the business ones first.
Right
on. Okay. So customer expectations for what they're looking for from a company such as yours have changed and are continuing to change. And how do you see them changing going forward, and to what extent will the Internet change what those look like?
Well, first of all, let me describe a little bit what FedEx's business really is. Sometimes, because you might deal with FedEx, one part of it, you might have an impression of the company that's a little bit of, like touching an elephant blindfolded. You don't see the entire shape of the animal. FedEx is about a $40 billion corporation, as I mentioned, employed in about 300,000 folks. We have four reportable business segments. The first is FedEx Services. That is a company which provides common sales representation, common information technology services, a retail branch, FedEx Office, which was formerly Kinko's, which we acquired and have been transitioning over to FedEx Office. It runs our supply chain group, which does customized warehouse management, pull packing, and ship inventory for pharmaceutical companies, high-tech companies, and things of that nature. The second, and by far our business operating segment, is the original Federal Express, FedEx Express. It operates into 220 countries around the world. It's the largest transporter of goods by air in the world. We have a great number of flights across the Pacific every day, a huge intra-Asia system you might have seen just this week. We opened up a mammoth new hub at the new Baiyun Airport in Guangzhou, China, at the headwaters of 60% of the China export market. We have a very big European operation, numerous flights across the Atlantic, a big operation in South America. As I mentioned, the company operates almost 700 planes. It's the biggest fleet of wide-body airplanes in the world of any type of carrier, and certainly the biggest all-cargo fleet. FedEx Ground is the second largest ground parcel business. While FedEx Express is mainly involved with the high-tech sector, semiconductors, PCs, iPods, auto parts, aviation parts, Louis Vuitton luggage, Hermes, fashion goods, anything that is a high-tech or high-value-added product, FedEx Ground offers economical transportation for generally the retail sector, for things moving to Walmart, to Costco's, Walgreens, CVS, the e-tailers, Amazon.com, and finally FedEx Freight, which is the largest regional less-than-truckload unit. Now, the reason I went through that is we have a very broad view of the economy, from FedEx Office that deals with architects and home building to FedEx Freight that's moving the refrigerators and the auto transmissions and so forth and everything in between. In fact, Chairman Greenspan used to kid publicly that one of his best economic indicators was seeing me at the Washington Redskins football game and seeing what the FedEx traffic count is. Now, different segments of our company are experiencing different things. Obviously, the financial sector and the industrial sector is more in distress than a lot of those high-tech and high-value-added trades. But overall, what I would say to you is our best guess is life on the planet is going to continue. And economic life is not going to cease because of this cycle. This is not a new thing. There are just a couple of unusual twists to this. The first of which is that we are far more globalized. In many ways, that's a good thing. As I mentioned in my speech, if we didn't have these fast cycle worldwide capabilities, I suspect our employment would be worse. And the second, as I mentioned, the financial sector has become a much larger segment of our society, and we have leveraged ourselves to a very significant degree. In 1983 to 2007, the U.S. gross domestic product increased about $12 trillion, maybe a bit more. At the same time, government debt, private debt of corporations, and personal debt increased by $45 trillion. Now, even a liberal arts major like me can figure out that that math doesn't work long term. So you have this worldwide financial market where the end has become itself, not as a supporting function, although that's clearly understood. Ken Lewis, the head of B of A today, in his testimony said that we've got to get back to that Churchillian thing that finance has got to be less proud. He didn't use that term. I did, but he said the same thing. So we're going through a massive deleveraging today, which is made wildly more cyclical because of the mark-to-market accounting which was introduced in the post-Enron world. But if you really look at the situation, the assets that are on the balance sheets of these banks, they aren't worth nothing. They are worth a lot more than people are willing to pay for them today. And as I mentioned, it's a bit like the fellow in the op-ed piece talked about trying to sell a house in Galveston before the hurricane hit. It's worth nothing. But the next day, it's worth a substantial amount. So what has to happen is things have to get into balance. And I think Treasury Secretary Paulson and his team made exactly the right decision to put the money on the equity side of the balance sheets. And I believe over time that you'll see this thing bleed off in a more normal cycle than a lot of the hysteria that's being inflamed by the talking heads and so forth. That doesn't mean it's going to be pretty, and that doesn't mean that there may be not more to come. But I think you can see, based on our traffic statistics and what we're hearing from our customers, there are a few robins flying out there in the industrial sector. And I think the financial sector will come right because it's not as draconian as it's being portrayed. Again, I don't want to minimize it. I'm just saying it's not. Let me give you one specific example, and we'll go to the next question. It was announced breathlessly and appropriately so that Merrill Lynch had lost $15 billion in the fourth quarter and that Bank of America had made a bad trade in one thing or another, and how could they have missed that? That wasn't a cash loss. That was the value of those so-called toxic assets because under mark-to-market accounting, the auditors and the company can no longer make a judgment based on the cash flow of those securities. In fact, a relatively small portion of the actual assets are subprime mortgages, which everybody blames on this thing. So most of these things are going to pay out over time. It's simply that with the assets being marked to market, because no one's willing to buy them, the bank's lending power is not as great as it would be otherwise. So I think when you really look at this thing a bit more dispassionately, you may see that there's hope coming out in the last part of this year and into FY10. I don't think we're going to be back to a gangbuster economy, but I'm not as pessimistic as a lot of folks are.
Okay. Just a quick reminder for our radio audience. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Fred Smith, founder and CEO of Federal Express, who is discussing his views on keeping America competitive in today's economic climate. You just mentioned that you are more optimistic than most about the outlook for the economy. 1 year from now, what do you think the economy is going to look like, and where do you think the most interesting growth opportunities around the world might be?
Well, we have a great economist, Gene Huang, who has been very prescient through all of this. I think Gene is looking for the inventory numbers to start turning a bit positive, meaning people will be ordering and shipping a bit more in late 2009, and I think our forecast for 2010 for the United States is 2.3% GDP, Europe a little less than that. Again, if you go around the FedEx system, and I was just in the UK last week and over in Asia, the entrepreneurship and the drive in Asia and China these days, people are not going to be satisfied to say, well, we've reached a plateau, we're not going to go any further, and all those hundreds of millions of people still out in the western part of the country, not going to worry about them bringing them up out of poverty. That's not going to happen. There's a tremendous market out there. We just got way beyond our level of leverage, appropriate leverage in the financial sector, and we just have to bring it back right.
Okay. If you were going to start a business today, what would that be?
Well, most areas that I would say are great opportunities that you were talking about there are way beyond my level of competence and understandings, like biotech, genetics, nanotechnology, battery technology. But I think for sure that the great industries ahead of us are in fields based on technology. I think that's why this is one of the great natural assets of the United States, the entire Bay Area with its incredible higher learning and Stanford and Silicon Valley and Cal and down in Southern California. So I think you can see I was on the board of the Mayo Clinic for years. It's astounding what's going on in the medical area. I think whole new industries are beginning to emerge there. I think nanotechnology offers the future for materials that are lighter, stronger, more durable, all kinds of things. So probably in those areas, but I would be a failure because I'm not smart enough to be in biotech, nanotechnology. So I'll try to think of another industrial area that I could go in.
Okay, great. A couple more provocative questions about business that were raised by a couple members of our audience. The first one has to do with executive compensation. What do you think of the administration's cap on CEO pay for companies taking government funds?
Well, I said this on a TV show on ABC last week, that if you take government money, the government's got the right to call the shots. I don't think that's necessarily a wise thing from a business standpoint, but that's the concomitant of taking public money, is the ability to regulate compensation at the top. Having said that, I certainly don't think it's wise to try to regulate compensation at the federal level for many reasons. Most importantly, because the whole idea of the joint stock company, which came up some 400 years ago and was manifested in the East India Company and the Hudson Bay Company and all, had as its core the spread the liability among shareholders and hold a group of elected officials, namely the board of directors, accountable for the management of those companies. And we talk now about public companies. That really is a misnomer. FedEx is not a public company in terms of the ownership by the government. It is a private company which has shareholders and shares which are traded publicly and overseen by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The board of directors is responsible for setting compensation. No question it got out of control, but it mostly got out of control in the financial sector. Why? Because when you're trading these billions and tens of billions of dollars, taking a little small slice on the upside is a tiny decimal point on the P&L for the enterprise, but in human terms, it's staggering. So it becomes a political issue of fairness and equity. The industrial sector has a few stories like that, but in the main, boards of directors have been responsible, and many of the reforms put in after the Enron era have been very effective. Boards of directors now, in the main, do not have staggered terms. There aren't poison pills. Each director is elected individually by majority vote. So if share owners want to make a change in executive compensation, they have a very easy way to do it. Vote against the compensation committee members. Markets work. So our private, publicly owned companies, boards, are responding. And I think with the meltdown of Wall Street, one of the good things, if there is such a thing out of a tragedy this size, is you're going to see these outsized Wall Street paychecks diminished enormously, simply because the leverage has to go down in this new era of mark-to-market and more sobriety in the financial sector.
Okay, let me ask another provocative question that we got from several of our attendees. Could you tell us how you feel about the proposed Employee Free Choice Act, how it might affect business? And then related, may or may not be related to that, would you care to comment on your relationships with the Teamsters Union?
I'm surprised they're not here tonight. They were down in Los Angeles. But on the Employee Free Choice Act, I don't think it's wise legislation. The reality is the system we have today, you wouldn't believe this by the rhetoric, produces, I think, in terms of the elections held, almost 50-50. The union wins about half, and maybe it's 44 or 45. I've seen the statistics, but it's not that the unions are being wiped out in the elections. They claim it's because companies intimidate employees and that sort of thing. Well, I can assure you that if you're worried about intimidation on that size, there'll be plenty of intimidation for somebody to walk up and want you to sign a card if that means automatic certification of the union. Now, you could make many reforms in terms of speeding up the election and doing things like that, but the most pernicious part of the so-called Employee Free Choice Act is the automatic mandatory arbitration provision, which says that if you have 51% of the card signed, you don't have an election, and you have a certification of a union, then 120 days you have a contract imposed. So the Teamsters, if that's the union, don't get to bargain, and management doesn't. It could be someone from a different part of the country that doesn't understand the situation, doesn't understand what the cost of living here is in San Francisco or what have you. So I think it's not well thought out legislation, and there are things you could do to make the process better. As I mentioned, maybe what you want to do is speed it up. But the arbitration, many people think it's simply unconstitutional. So we don't think that that's a good thing. And you've noticed that President Obama gave a speech to a group of labor folks the other day. He didn't mention it. And that's because I think there is a very large and growing opposition to this as being undemocratic and particularly in this time not well thought out. Our relationships with the Teamsters are simply this, that the Teamsters are a big business. They're in the business of representing folks. They would love to have our hundreds of thousands of folks as their members paying them their dues. That's their right. And if they can convince our folks to do it, then that's their success. On the other side of the coin, it's our employees' choice in that regard, not mine and not the unions. And so we think that as long as all the cards are up on the table, we have the right to put our story out, and we have consistently been ranked as one of the top companies in America to work for. In fact, we are the largest company that's owned the best company to work for in the United States. And the reason we get on that list is we try to do the right thing for our folks out there on the front line. Nobody sees me when you deal with FedEx. You're dealing with our team members out there that are trying to keep our so-called purple promise. I will make every FedEx experience outstanding, very clear to everybody. So we understand on the bridge of the ship that the folks that are out there pulling it are the ones that deserve the most attention. And we've tried to do that, and some of you may have seen that our executive compensation was cut. Our management compensation was cut. We felt we should do that before we had to take any action with our volume-related folks. So I certainly have no antipathy. Anybody that says that the union movement wasn't a great thing for bringing the United States into the modern world would be disingenuous. On the other side of the coin, I don't think that their model is the end-all and a one-size-fits-all. We have a union in our pilots, and in fact, FedEx was commended by our union as being a model of labor management relations in the last contract.
Okay. On to another set of questions. There were a large number of questions about your comments about energy independence and move to alternative energy. Let me try and group these into one category, which is, to what extent does the current price, lower price of oil, going to disincent the movement that you've talked about? How is that going to be influenced by the current economic crisis?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, I've been through four of these things. When I first started FedEx's operations in the spring of 1973, we were in the midst of the Arab oil embargo. That was a geopolitical supply disruption. In 1979, when the Shah was overthrown, we had another supply interruption. In 1990 and 91, Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, another supply disruption. The prices ran up. The last go-around, in the last several years, as I mentioned, culminating in July, a very different proposition. The first time, it was a demand crisis. The emergence of China and India and the demand for petroleum, given the increasingly nationalized nature of the oil business, as I mentioned, the difficulties of extracting it from remote and inhospitable and tough locations meant that the demand simply outstripped the supply, and it went through the roof, fueled by people getting in and buying it as a financial instrument. Now, why do I think that this time is going to be different? It's because people understand that the cause of the crisis was different. And the Energy Security Leadership Council, as I told you, we have four four-star generals and admirals of distinguished careers. My co-chairman is General P.X. Kelly, the former commandant of the Marine Corps. I'm his co-chairman, really. I'm his XO. It's not the other way around. But in my view, he would be gracious enough to say we were co-chairmen. I'm going to tell you, I used to tremble at the sight of a bird colonel, much less a four-star general when I was in the Marine Corps. But they're out there telling the American people this is no longer, something we can ignore. This is, after terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, some horrible terrorism event in the United States, this is our biggest national security issue. It's not China. China is our trading partner. We do a huge amount of business with China. They don't have any ill will towards us. I mean, they it's a very wonderful country that has great affection for Americans. Our problem is we're too dependent on imported petroleum. And the next time, it's not going to stop at $147 a barrel. It'll be $247 a barrel. The second thing is that this time around, people are concerned about the environmental impact of CO2. And everyone wants to try to do their part to reduce the carbon footprint if they can do it in an economically affordable basis. And the reality is, with appropriate tax credits and supports, we can cross that chasm to an electrified plug-in hybrid system that's got the equivalent of 150 miles per gallon. It's an electric motor, small gasoline motor that simply operates as a generator after you go past 40 or 50 miles. And the third reason I think that it's going to happen is what I have in my hand right here, this little tiny telephone. When I was growing up, I used to read the Dick Tracy cartoons, and the guy was talking on a wrist radio. I said, "That's ridiculous." Guess what? You can get a wrist radio today and talk to anybody in the world, 10 or 11 digits. The battery technology that's been developed for this small telephone and for the netbooks and the laptops is coming down the learning curve. Now, the problem we have in this country, guess who's ahead in the battery race? South Koreans, the Japanese, they've been investing in it for years. That's why Senator McCain, during his campaign, wanted a huge prize for a real breakthrough battery technology. And I think that that should be one of the government initiatives. The stimulus bill doesn't seem like it does much to me, except the smart grid certainly makes a lot of sense. But we need to be trying to move this kind of stimulation into industrial production. So I do think this time is different. And I do think that the lower gasoline prices will make it harder, but I think those three things have changed the situation from times past.
Okay. There were another set of questions around your tax proposals. Mm-hmm. And what is your outlook on the possibility of having any tax reform during this year? And would you be willing to support a lower corporate tax, as you suggested, in exchange for switching to a carbon tax?
Sure. I think the cap and trade idea is very ill-founded. It will be gamed, lobbied. It will not achieve its objectives. And if you don't believe that, just go look at the experience of Europe who tried it. If the government of the United States, the elected people in the United States, decide that the United States needs to reduce the amount of carbon that we burn and the CO2 we emit in the atmosphere, tax it. That's straightforward and simple. You get a feedback every time you fill up your tank or every time we take off a plane. I would say if you want to do that, tax the carbon and lower the payroll tax. You want less carbon and more employment, it's pretty simple to me. Math is great. Reduce taxes on employment and increase taxes on carbon. It's much better than cap and trade. I'm not promoting that because I think we can get there through efficiency measures just as well. But that's a much better public policy choice than some type of arcane thing. And really, when you get down to it in the main, one of the reasons cap and trade is so popular with the political class is because the rank and file people don't understand it. And they would understand a carbon tax.
Okay. Unfortunately, we reached the point in this evening's program where there's time for only one more question, but I'm going to cheat a little bit and make it a two-part question and perhaps end with the hardest question of the evening for you. The first part of the question is, how would you rate our education system in the U.S. to help prepare the next generation for the commerce market that you see? And then the hardest question of all, as a parent of children who attended both Duke and the University of North Carolina, who are you rooting for in tonight's game?
Oh, Lord. Well, it's tonight. The game's going on right this minute. They probably tipped off. You know, I'm rooting for whichever one of my children I just talked to that went to whichever institution. I'm not a politician in general, but I'm a good enough politician to know how to answer that question. The other question was the
education system and how's it preparing
the system. The main reason the United States is so successful in the modern economy is our system of higher education. Why is that the case? Because our system of higher education is heterogeneous. You have Stanford, you have Caltech, you have Harvard, you have Ole Miss, you have the University of Miami, where I have a child at the moment, my last one that's in college. You have University of Tennessee, a great logistics school. You've got MIT, aeronautics, invented, for all intents and purposes, radar. You have the University of Arkansas, also a great transportation school. University of Texas, computers, on and on down the line with all of these incredible specializations and abilities. And it has provided the entrepreneurs and the inventors and the innovators that have created human wealth. The government creates no wealth whatsoever. It can invest in infrastructure to help, and it can help in certain basic research, swept wing, airplane, multi-stage rockets, ARPANET that leads into the internet. But it's those entrepreneurs and inventors and scientists and all that have given us the standard of living that we have today. And they have come from our higher education system. I think the problem, and it is the best in the world, it is, and if you want to see going the other way where you standardize, homogenize, bring everything down to the same level, go to Germany. And they will tell you it's one of the biggest mistakes they ever made to try to make a single university system when they had these great universities before World War II. Clearly, the primary education system, the K-12 system, is failing. Why is it failing? Well, note every one of the attributes I gave you to our great higher education system, and you can turn them on your head. Completely homogeneous, monopoly providers in the main, averaging down rather than up. And so we simply have to recognize that you're going to, in my opinion, restore powers to principals and parents and go at this thing a different way. Otherwise, we're going to have a hard time maintaining that leadership position. I also think there's another thing that's missed, and that is one of the other really great groups of educational institutions are our community colleges, because the community colleges are very in tune with what employers like FedEx, they're turning out aircraft and power plant licensed maintenance people. They're turning out people that work on our sort systems, that work on our IT systems, and so forth. And I think one of the things we ought to really focus on is to put more aid out there for the community college and the trade schools, which provide very well-paying jobs, and perhaps not turn out quite, not that I'm against anthropologists or anything, my daughter-in-law is one, but to some degree, our educational system is turning out some people that don't have good employment prospects, where we have great employment prospects at this very moment for six-figure jobs and machine tools and aviation and so forth that go begging because we can't match up the demand with the supply.
All right. Well, our thanks to Fred Smith, founder and CEO of Federal Express. We'd also like to thank our audiences here and on the radio. Tonight's program has been underwritten by the University of San Francisco School of Business and Management. And we do want to remind everyone in the auditorium to please remain seated just for a moment until Mr. Smith has left the room. So I'm Lenny Mendonca, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.